Yes, what's the allowance, the allowed amount?
Essentially, the regulatory limit's 100 mil rim to somebody, a member of the public, but there's lower limits, and I want to say it's 5 mil rim, you have to forgive me, I don't remember the exact number. I believe it's 5 mil rim for gaseous and 3 mil rim for liquid. I could have it backwards. But again, it's very low level. That's per year. And then going going from memory, but the effluent that was released last year from Songs was I'm probably going to be high. It was no more than a tenth of a millirem to a member of the public. So that would be 0.1 millirem, and that's probably too high by a factor of 10, approximately. So a 0.1 millirem was what was released, both gaseous and liquid effluent, at Songs last year. Again, I could be off a little bit, but it's pretty close to that value.
All right, final question here.
Let me just interject. To make sure we get your response back to that conversion, if you could fill out a feedback form and ask your question, that will ensure that we can get directly back to you.
And in the steam, what kind of radioisotopes were existing?
It's, again, without looking at specific, I think it's argon, noble gas, iodine, thank you.
Argon. Yeah, predominant radionuclides released were argon-41, xenon-133, xenon-136, and, I'm sorry, 135. And then there were some iodine components to noble gases.
Yes, sir. What's your name?
Harold Johnston, San Diego. And you talk about tube wear greater than 10%. So what's the upper limit on tube degradation that you're going to accept before you say it's bad? And how do you monitor tube wear and vibration while the unit is running?
On the tube plugging, there's actually a limit in tech spec that's limited to 35%. Once you reach that level, it has to be plugged. But again, that's a simplistic answer. Of course, when they do these steam generator inspections, before they restart, they have to go ahead and do analysis to show that that won't be reached before the next outage. Because again, if it happens, it's not acceptable per technical specification. So they have to go ahead and make an analysis to show that they won't have that much wear before the next time they get to the outage. I'm sorry, what was your last question?
How are you able to evaluate degradation and amount of vibration while the unit is running?
Actually, there is no current way right now that you can evaluate vibration with the unit running. It's actually being looked at as a potential method in the future. They are doing it on boiling water reactors, which is a different type of reactor, slightly different environment, not as harsh. But it doesn't last for very long because it is a very harsh environment. And you just can't go stick that on the tubes because you may create an issue. If that detector was to fall off, it could actually cause tube wear and tube damage and cause a leak. So there are issues that have to be explored before that gets done.
All right. Mr. Cruz has a question.
Yes. Had there been no unexpected tube-to-tube degradation, and were there not to be some major local close seismic event, and were everything to go as projected, what would have been the minimum extended life expectancy of this plant? And I ask this to get some idea of whether Southern Cal Edison has a sound business plan.
Thank you.
I'm not sure I totally understand your question, but the plant's originally designed for 40 years.
And it began construction when?
Yes, I was thinking about approximately $700 million already spent on the renewal and upgrading of the plant. All the additional costs, which will come from modifying the flaws that have been found, and about the approximate loss of $1 million a day from lost revenue. So these little half-inch tubes have quite an expensive bottom line.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Next question.
Given the
My understanding is that the plant originally on its 40-year licensing agreement would end in 2014. Is that correct?
There's essentially 10 years.
Okay, so this is my first question. How did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission find it acceptable to have, as I understand it, two $600 million steam generators approved for a plant that only had 10 years left in the hopes that it would last 40 to 60 years, given that my understanding is that any machinery is sort of like a car. I think of it as a car, where if you don't do any tune-ups on a car, beautiful muscle car that was built in, say, the 60s, and then you turn around and say, oh, I think it's time for a tune-up, that car doesn't, everyone probably will know if they don't already, knows that that car doesn't adjust well to that tune-up and it never runs quite the same again. So I'm wondering again how the NRC approved new steam generators that will last 40 to 60 years when the licensee only goes for another 10.
Again, that's not considered as part of what the NRC looks at as far as the economic life. And it's based upon safety. The old generators did have some issues. They couldn't reach full power, and the utility decided to go ahead and upgrade. So we looked at it, again, from a safety perspective, not from an economic perspective.
Last question from this lady.
I have a question about the exact design change. And since I have to include it in my second question, I want to know what whether the U design was changed to a V design, and if any of these concerns were brought up by the whistleblower that was hushed recently by the Southern California Edison Company.
Actually, the steam generators, and Evan might be able to help me too, the original steam generators had what they call a square bend. The new steam generators have a U-bend, and so they're actually shaped like a U. The other ones were more a square-type arrangement. As far as a whistleblower, I'm not aware of... if you give me a little more details, I'm not aware of a whistleblower.
In the press, a while back, there was a whistleblower who came to light, and I don't know what he whistleblew. I'm wondering if those concerns were generated in any way on any of these issues?
I don't have any knowledge of the individual that you're talking about or what the concern was. Sorry.
And I would add, by policy, and I think for good reason, when people bring us concerns, we protect their identity in that process to the maximum extent we can. If we did know of it, I don't think I would be able to convey that to you in a way that might connect it to, and confirm that someone had brought us a concern. So,
thank you. I'm Marty Magda, and I appreciate Mr. Collins, you being here again. I did hear you last September, and that's when I got the most frightened, because you said 7-0 protection against earthquake was adequate. So now that we look at this steam generator problem, and you're telling us that it's only guaranteed at a 7-0 earthquake, and we look at the way in which I hear the language sometimes, I think, or it's my understanding. And I remember Tony Eisman standing there giving us a quote of a man who said, these are going to be the best. They will be wonderful. And the response from one of you was, well, that was before my time. So my question is, who is ultimately accountable? Whose name goes on this forever? That we can all say this name, this person, said that these were safe. Because there's not a person in this room that has confidence in people with the Nuclear Regulatory System or Edison. They keep the language I already knew when you're saying tube to tube. You're hiding something. You do this to protect yourselves and I guess to make us feel comfortable. None of us feel comfortable. The latest concern of these steam generators, not just that earthquake could ruin things. We haven't even talked about firestorm that could come through that took 140 homes in Laguna Beach, that every September we go against firestorms that could put all of the men working and women working at San Onofre at stake. And what if we have at the same time steam generator pipes that start to crack? What is your backup for all of these possible contingencies? And who ends up, whose name goes on this for the history of the world if we go to Fukushima? Whose name is saying this is safe?
Thank you.
There was a lot in your question. I think we've already talked about seismic. The size of the earthquake, I think, is translated to ground motion at the site. That's what it's designed for. We are requiring all licensees to reassess that seismic hazard with the latest scientific information that's available and update it if necessary. So more work to be done on seismic to make sure that we have a facility that's built the way it needs to be built. With respect to whose name goes on the... I tell you, I licensed Southern California Edison. It's the name on the license. They are the ones that primarily take the responsibility for safety, to make sure the regulations are met, to make sure that the facility is operated as it's supposed to be operated, and for this specific issue, you know, I'm looking, but to make sure that when steam generators are changed, that it's done properly, and design objectives are met, and so that's what. That's my job as a federal regulator, and we conduct inspection programs and assessment programs to check that along the way. So we, within the law and within our procedures and our guidelines, but we tell you, it's the name on the license that bears the responsibility for safety. So.
All right, thank you, Elmo. Charles has a question about the steam generator.
It's Charles Michael Murray from Laguna Beach. Am I understanding that the new generators that have gone in both Reactor 2 and 3 are unique, that there's one that's kind of similar someplace else, but they're unique, and there isn't anything identical on the planet that we can compare and contrast to, so the situation is unique, and we're being exposed to this. Am I understanding this correctly?
You're correct. These generators are the only type of generators in the world. There are similar generators at Palo Verde, Waterford, A&O, Fort Calhoun, St. Lucie. But again, these specific generators designed by Mitsubishi, these are unique generators here. The size-wise.
If that's the case... How did they get approved to be placed in an environment with 8 million people?
Again, as we discussed earlier, they did go through the 5059 review process, and we are still reviewing that process, but this time we have not identified anything that would have required a license amendment other than those two items I talked about earlier that did go through the license amendment review.
Thank you, Garrett. Thank you, Greg.
Residents of Orson, Organized for a Safe Environment, would like to ask that before the plant is restarted, that a cost-benefit analysis be done by the California Public Utility Commission to determine whether it's cost-effective for the citizens to have the plant reopened. And within that investigation, it should be considered the twice-through cooling that is required by state law, but both nuclear power plants in California are only doing once-through cooling and have been given a three-year extension because they say it's too expensive to do. But the law is, and they have closed coal-fired plants for this and gas-fired plants for the once-through cooling, and why shouldn't California Edison and this be considered into the cost-benefit analysis?
If I understand your question, it's about what some your request of some information being provided to the California Public Utilities Commission and then the cost for the implementation of the cooling that's employed. I don't know if Pete or anyone from Edison would want to tackle. I'm not cognizant. The NRC doesn't have purview over the interaction with the California Public Utilities Commission. So I guess I'm unable to be responsive to your request.
All right, folks, it's getting a little late, and I promised one gentleman I would get back and let him finish, so I'm going to do that. And I'm not done yet, okay?
Thank you very much. There's been some great questions asked tonight, and much more analytical. I tended to be more just going with the analogy of the intervention and stuff. I thought it was important, and I just wanted to finish up my final conclusion. It's been mentioned a little bit tonight, and I know there's some questions, gray areas of jurisdiction and stuff, but it's a real human question, and I just want to finish my thought, please. It has been a rewarding game for some, and we are grateful, especially considering Japan's fate, that we have not lost everything in one bad bet. Nature holds the wild card where anything is possible, but so far she has been kind to us. We are here to tell you it is time to take your winnings and go home. Don't even ask to place one more bet. That would only confirm your gambling disorder and codependent relationship. This is the time for introspection and reconciliation. We look forward to getting to a place where everybody wins, embracing the future with a healthy, renewed perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
Folks, we're going to take three more questions, and then I'm going to ask that you submit any remaining questions on those feedback forms that I spoke of earlier. They're out in the lobby on the table. So we're going to have three last questions, and we're going to wrap it up for the night. You want to stand?
My name is Tara Cunningham. I'm a pediatric nurse. And one of the things that's been in the news lately is that because of new information about the internal and external radiation exposures to children, the new recommendations now are that they do not receive as many or as intensive imaging because they found that they've increased the amount of leukemia and brain tumors in these children by 7 times. We have a number of children that live close to San Onofre. There is a direct proportional increase in risk for leukemia and other things and the amount of time living near a nuclear reactor. We have lots of different radiation exposures that continue to fall upon us. Some are being released by San Onofre. Some are coming over through the jet stream from Fukushima. Some of it's been here since the nuclear testing that went on in the 50s. Who is adding up the total exposure for our area? Some of these radioisotopes can stay lethal, harmful for hundreds of thousands of years. Who's adding up the total and measuring the total amount of radiation exposure in our population and determining what level of risk, and how are the new information, what were you guys calling it, the new learnings about the true risks to human life being implicated into the testing that's being done and the regulations that are being used to determine the risk assessment on this nuclear power plant.
Thank you.
Yeah, I share your concerns about children with radiation. I have a 6-year-old, and actually up until about a year and a half or 2 years ago, I didn't realize how much radiation a CAT scan, that's the study that you're talking about. I actually heard that the other day. For perspective, a CAT scan, a whole body CAT scan, you get between 2,000 to 5,000 millirem for each whole body CAT scan. And again, for a child, that has to be a way that's something you talk to your medical doctor to see if the benefit outweighs the risk. You're absolutely correct. As compared to like what the plant released last year, like I said, it was around 0.2 0.1 millirem versus 2,000 to 5,000 millirem. I think, as Greg indicated, naturally occurring radiation is about 360 millirem, and then from other sources, about 600, 650 millirem per year. Again, the radiation was measured here along the coast in very low levels, but yes, actually it does all add up. But again, still very low levels as compared to, for instance, the CAT scan. They're talking, you know, thousands of times more radiation due to CAT scans, which you get naturally.
I'd like to add a few thoughts. Your question about who adds it up, who takes a look at the total picture. I think it's well established. I think that, you know, we in NRC believes, there's a no threshold linear relationship. You know, any exposure to radiation has the prospect. Now, at the levels we're talking about, it's practically negligible and incalculable. But there are many other sources of radiation. For NRC licensed material, which is the nuclear power plant, and most medical uses of cobalt therapies and many of the diagnostic treatments, we look at those radiation exposures. And in terms of a risk to people off-site at San Onofre, we are engaged currently with the National Academy of Sciences to propel another cancer study to see what the data does show with respect to that. The previous study did not show a correlation of increased cancer with respect to exposure from the nuclear power plant. But we are engaged again to redo that study. It's a very difficult study because when you take a 0.1 perhaps calculable dose and compare that to 2 rem, 5 rem, from CAT scans and other radiation, how do you tease that out in the study? And that's what the National Academy of Sciences is struggling with that right now. How are they going to do that and what data they're going to get? So we are serious about that. We want to complete that study and get the best data we can. So we'll see where it goes. I'm not. Are you potentially referring to the EPA radiation that were potentially?
We wouldn't be in a position.
I just don't have the information on that. So.
Anyway, we're going to hear from Lynn Harris Hicks here.
I live 2 miles from San Onofre. I've lived there for most of my life, and my children and grandchildren are living in the radiation that you put forth. And we know that it has raised what they call the natural background. There's no natural background of radiation. It's a man-made poison. It's the worst poison that we've ever discovered how to put out to kill people. And it's being used to kill people in the countries overseas, in the armaments. And we just can't keep on doing this. And so when you sit there and talk about, you have to look a little more to see what happened on this one or that one, and you don't have any idea whether when you once started again that the next week it might be all over again in different ones of those tubes. Because the truth of it is that the metals are the basic fault here. And that won't be mentioned because that's the way the nuclear industry has gotten all of its, and I shouldn't say all, never say all, and the nuclear industry has gotten its guarantees, loan guarantees, because without the loan guarantees, they couldn't build anything. They waited a generation. Oh, no, I mustn't get off on that. The point is that when you know that you've not been able to create an alloy which can resist the terrible destructive action of this terrible technology, why do you go ahead looking for the little bits of fragments of what might have influenced it, making it worse or less worse? When our lives are in our lives, 8 million, right? Of us, and probably a lot more than that, because we are learning every day about from Fukushima that radiation is coming over us and it's making more and more people, and particularly the children. Now, how can you do that? How can you look in the mirror and do that?
Thank you, Ms. Hicks. Charles?
Well, I'd like to just comment. And, you know, there's really probably nothing I can say to Ms. Hicks, you know, except I do appreciate her sentiment and her challenge to us as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to make sure we do our job with respect to safety. And on these particular issues, I'll just tell you, we are committed to make sure that we understand this with the best science and engineering that's available right now. And San Onofre is not going to run again until we're satisfied. So thank you for your comment.
All right. It's going to be... Elmo?
Well, I'm just doing a time check. We have to be out by 10, I think.
Okay, this is going to be our final question. Charles?
My name is Charles Griffin. I like to speak about the tubes. My wife just passed away in December from lung cancer. Isn't that interesting? Okay. But about the tubes, and you've learned tonight that this is a different design. And I've learned tonight that it's quite a bit different design than what was originally there. And why didn't it trigger? I initiated the California Environmental Quality Act in 1970. It was passed by Nixon and Gilder Brown passed the California Environmental Quality Act. Why isn't there an environmental impact statement for the National Environmental Protection Act? Why haven't we got an environmental impact report for the tubes on this? And because it involves looking for alternatives. And certainly we have cheap natural gas, and that's certainly a workable alternative. We just built a natural gas facility at Donovan Airport. So we can build local ones. We can put them out in the desert. We don't have to cover our desert with solar cells. But we also can build an alternative utilizing hydrogen and boron and make a fusion reactor there that's the size of a bathroom, and you can put it in any substation and diversify this with a smart grid. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
I want to make sure I understand the question. Okay, good. Thank you. Federal law tells us when the environmental impact statement...
If I got to go to court and have a judge decide whether
I... I'm sorry. I stated that poorly. That wasn't what I was trying to convey. First of all, Mr. Griffin, let me express my condolences on the loss of your wife. I'm sorry to hear that. But the IRC and the implementation of our provisions, you know, has those in our regulations about when an environmental impact statement should be triggered, and we believe we followed those regulations in this instance. But we also acknowledge, because of the prospect for a license amendment, which might trigger additional reviews or additional federal actions, and at least a statement of no significant hazards determination. We got to go back and through our inspection and review and make sure we got this one right. And it's actually a question we're asking ourselves as well, and we haven't arrived at the answer yet. So thank you,
ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry the night's wearing long. Please give us your questions on those feedback forms. But before you go, I want to thank you for the thoughtful questions and comments that you've all come out and asked. I want to thank you again for your time. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you very much. And I'm going to let Mr. Collins have the last word here.
Yeah, I just want to, Rick already said what I wanted to say, and that's my personal appreciation for you taking the time to come out. Your questions, we've done our best to try to answer your questions and be forthright with it. Just to restate what we've indicated a number of times, we're not satisfied yet. A lot of work has to be done for this difficult technical issue. We're going to have more meetings, and we're going to continue to talk about it before NRC makes a decision. So I expect I'm going to get to see you again, and we'll get to talk about this some more. So thank you very much for your attendance tonight.